It's a new world. 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 It's a new world.
Yo, celebrate the new life. New ways to make money. New ways to break dummies. Forge they name and take money. Computers ain't that smart. Whatever man built.
Two Dimension Comics, episode 18. Like dudes started rocking platinum. Some stopped wearing gold. Happy New Year and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. I'm your host, Dallas Busha, and thank you for joining us for our very first episode of 2012. I hope you all had a great holiday. I know we did here at the show. All of us got a lot of new comics for Christmas, and I, for one, have a lot of material to talk about on our upcoming shows. We also had a Two Dimension Comics field trip to the Yancey Street Comics Convention in Largo, Florida, where we met up with our good friend Silent Bill. But why don't I let the other guys tell you about it? Don and Al are hosting this episode, so without further ado, gentlemen, take it away.
All right, well, here we are again. This is Al.
And this is Don. Hello.
And this is Two Dimension Podcast number 18, right?
I think it's 19. Well, I think it's 19.
It's 18 or 19, I think.
It's been a while. Happy New Year, everybody.
That's right. Happy New Year. And Merry Christmas, too.
Yeah, we took a bit of a hiatus. We're supposed to get together. Rook is living off the grid, as we talked about before. And Dallas is going to come, and then things came up, and he couldn't. He apologized, but we're just getting the show out today.
That's right. Dallas will be on this show in one form or another.
Yeah.
Maybe. So let's talk about that convention we were at.
Yeah, Rook and Dallas is always talking about the Yancey Street Comics up in... Where is that? Port Richey.
It's Port Richey, yeah.
It's a nice store. They had their first convention. It was down in Largo, Florida, at the Mini Rig Center. And it was on December the 18th that we went. And I'll tell you, it was probably my favorite convention I've ever been to.
Yeah, it was really cool because it was a big enough place that it would hold like a lot of dealers, but it wasn't like a madhouse. And everybody had nice, reasonable prices, and it was laid back in a way.
Yeah, it was small. I guess, you know, MegaCon, it was not even an eighth of the size of the MegaCon. But to me, it seemed like they had a much bigger variety of stuff. Everybody seemed like they were just there to have fun. I mean, you know, you had a lot of vendors, but it didn't seem like you were getting gouged. I was surprised at what they had. A lot of dollar boxes and 50-cent boxes.
Yeah, we did pretty good, actually.
Yeah, I bought five comics I already owned, but I just...
But, you know, you liked them so much, you got them
well,
again.
Well, it's the problem, you know. I don't know. You got to take it home and love it, I guess. Two of my favorite comics is when Steve Laiolola drew the first two issues of Coyote under Epic Comics. I remember that was building up. They were advertising it for I don't know how long in the books. They had a drawing he did, and it had a coyote, and it had a gun to the coyote's head and says, "If you don't buy this book, we'll kill this coyote."
That was a National Lampoon cover, actually.
Yeah, there was a National Lampoon, but they did that on the Epic. Steve Laiolola drew it. And I like Steve Laiolola. I used to read him in Star Reach, and I used to read him. He did Spider-Woman with Chris Claremont for Marvel. And, so I was excited about the book, and those two issues, just two of my, I couldn't believe what he accomplished. And then he left the book. You know, other people did it, but that was one of my great things. I wish he would have, I still dream that he'll come back and just draw all the other issues these guys did, which is insane.
Yeah.
But every time I find one of these books, you know, one of these two issues in the cutout rack, I buy it.
I just think,
well... It was so great, I never get tired of picking it up, which I guess is insanity, but anyway, I did that a few times. I bought the first issue of Coyote twice at that convention.
Well, you know, it makes a great Christmas gift.
But I asked Dallas, I said, "Do you want one?" "No."
You know, it's funny you mentioned Star Reach, because at the first convention that I ever went to back in Miami, it was at the Marriott Hotel. God, it must have been like 74. That was one of the first fanzines I ever bought was a Star Reach, and it had a Cody Starbucks story by
Howard Chaykin.
And it had early Jim Starlin. And I remember it was like, wow, look at this. It's a fanzine. I've never seen this thing before. These are really cool.
Yeah, it was, I can't remember what, Mike Friedrich, I guess, was the publisher of that. He didn't call them underground comics. They were,
were they called like above ground comics?
I guess, and he had a term for it, but basically he kept saying, I'm going to make comics fun again. But I guess he was a comics professional.
Yeah, he was.
But he, I mean, Barry Smith did work in it. Craig Russell did work
in it. Yeah, yeah.
Howard Chaykin. Ditko. Yeah. Dick Giordano did work. Mike Volsberg. It was a blast. Lee Mars, which I guess was an underground cartoonist.
That's right, yeah.
That was, I didn't like her work at first. As a matter of fact, I get upset it was in there thinking, this is garbage, I'm paying for this, and what's this in there? She absolutely turned into one of my favorites.
Yeah, I like Lee Mars.
It wasn't a style that I didn't care for at first, but she ended up being just absolutely fantastic. I'm still working. I think she's working as a political cartoonist. She's pretty dynamic. But she wrote her stories, lettered everything. She was just fantastic. But yeah, the Star Reach books, I don't have all of them, but I got quite a bit. But yeah, they were just a blast.
Yeah, but I mean, it was like, oh wow, this is like completely different comic, because it was kind of like risque also. It dealt with more adult, you know, and it really wasn't an underground because it wasn't as like subversive in a way as the undergrounds were.
Yeah, it still had the mainstream sensibility on some of the stories, but you could just do anything you wanted, and then, you know, but it had the underground quality to it too, because
black and white. Cheap paper.
I think, you know, people were, you know, putting adult things in it, but it wasn't sophomoric, like putting it in just to put it in. It
was
like,
if
the story called for it, you know, they would, you know, it wasn't taboo, you could do it, but it wasn't like blatant and grotesque. Yeah, they were really nice.
Yeah, but anyway, but that the Yancey convention was real nice because it was like, what was it, about 15 or 20 deals, and everybody seemed really friendly and nice. They weren't like really like pushing you or anything like that.
It reminded me when I was a kid, you know, the few conventions I went to. My favorite was, you know, you always walk around looking, and then at the very back, this guy had 50-cent boxes and dollar boxes. You started thumbing through them, and I was going, I couldn't believe it. I found some old Archies from the 60s for 50 cents. I found an old Dennis the Menace issue for 50 cents, and you got quite a stack.
Well, yeah, here's some of them here. I mean, it's like, what is this, Metamorpho number 5 for like $2? Some Old World's Finest, an issue of Werewolf from Dell Comics by the great Tony Tallarico.
Yeah, who we talked about before.
Justice League 30. I mean, some of these are not in perfect condition, but they're very readable. Some Boris Karloff's, Archie's, of course. I mean, I hope this dealer is back again when I go to a convention, because this guy had like a ton of stuff, and it was like for $2 or $1. So Hawkman number 12.
Then, you know, the Dennis the Menace I got, you know, the cover had some wear on it, but it was still good enough shape, and you can read it. As a matter of fact, I took it home. My wife saw it, and she started reading it. She looked at the Archies and said, do they still publish that?
She
knew them in the Philippines. She'd see them. But, yeah, it was. I remember we told that one dealer, I said, you got the best stall here. And he goes, that must be where they stuck me in the back. But, you know, there's people all around. And that's the thing, the whole attitude of the show. I remember you and I were thumbing through boxes, and there was another guy next to us, and he was got a little ahead of us. And I said, here, let me get out of your way. Oh, no, that's okay. And he'd go on the other side. Everybody was just, like, having fun and didn't mind, you know.
Yeah, you had a few cosplay people there, you know, doing their thing,
but
costume show.
Everybody just seemed to be happy to be there, and I'm going to put that on the people that put it together. It seemed like the whole attitude was just nice. It didn't seem like people were trying to gouge. I'm sure it's worth everybody's while, but, yeah. And we met Silent Bill.
That's right, Silent Bill. We're going to try to get him maybe to not be so silent, but he's still silent right now.
Yeah, He wrote one post for us. We had plans for him to write others. He said he would, but he still hasn't. But really nice and actually extremely interesting.
Yeah. I didn't know he was Silent Bill at first. I was like, oh, okay, hey, how are you? Oh, that's nice art. And then it's like, oh, that's Silent Bill. Oh, my God, Silent Bill, how the hell are you?
So, yeah, it was all around. It was all props. We got to meet Rook's son. And
he was a nice kid.
Yeah, it was
And
fun.
Rook got all dressed up.
Rook really dressed as Guy Gardner. I didn't believe it. But it was really nice, actually. It was a good costume.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to go. Since MegaCon, I hadn't been to one. It was kind of fun to go to kind of a more laid-back one because you can actually sit back and, you know, talk about stuff and then go hit the boxes again and just kind of like MegaCon, as great as it was, it just, you got lost in there. It was so packed.
Yeah, well, you think, I really had a good time. I hope we go back this next year at MegaCon. It was fun, but. You know, I guess what disappointed me was it seemed like everybody had about the same 5 to 10 books. But, you know, they all had trades or hardbacks. But you looked through one dealer, and that's all he had, and you went to the next dealer, and that's all they had. And it seemed like everybody had about the same 20 comic books.
Right.
And
right.
I was really surprised at a place that size. Yeah, I mean, there was others. There were some that sold Golden and Silver Age comics, which I can't afford to get.
right, yeah.
But, you know, I was kind of surprised that just there wasn't too much diversity there. A friend of ours, she goes every year, and she was talking about that year. It seemed like everybody had the same thing, and they just over-ordered, and they were trying to get rid of something. But the Yancey Street one, there was actually kind of diverse. And I don't think I've ever went through so many 50-cent and dollar boxes in my life.
That's right, because I don't remember that. I remember a couple of 50-cent, maybe dollar boxes at MegaCon, but it was mostly people selling, like you said, the same books. I mean, Dallas did find, you know, Asterios Polyp. They're pretty cheap for 50 cents. But, I mean, I usually like to go to these places to get deals, not to get, you know, gouged or anything
like
that.
Yeah, well, I bought some hardbacks at MegaCon, and they did, a lot of the trades we bought were like, you know, $5.
Yeah, it was a good deal.
You know, they were actually really good deals. So, I mean, it was fine. I guess I was expecting there'd be a lot more diversity, and you could find a lot of stuff that you're looking for that, you know, you can't find anywhere else, and it wasn't the case. But yeah, the Yancey, I had a blast. It was, I hope they do it again. It looked like successful.
I think so, yeah.
But yeah, it was, the atmosphere was, like I said, it was fun. It didn't seem like they were trying to gouge the daylights out of you like normal. So.
Like some of the, you know, I mean, yeah, when we went to MegaCon, I was like, we just went for that day, and the guests, it was hard to get in there because it was packed, and it was like, you go through, you know, you go through some guys' tables, and there's 50 people there, and you're like, excuse me, you know, elbowing everybody all the way, and you know, after a while, you say, I give up, you know, I can't take this anymore. I mean, maybe, you know, I'm glad that they're doing well, but it was just a little, it's a little nicer when it's more laid back.
Yeah, it was a fun convention. I was going to go no matter what, and it's fun to go with your friends, but yeah, that one. That's one of my very favorite conventions. And one thing I feel bad, when we were digging through that first dealer's boxes, there was two creators sitting there, and I looked at them, and they, oh, hello. And they kind of presented themselves, hi. And I looked away. I didn't know who they were, and I feel bad. I should have talked to them. But
yeah, there were a lot of artists there. I mean, I recognized Greg Land.
Yeah, I saw him drawing. As a matter of fact, Silent Bill was waiting for a sketch.
That's right, yeah, that's right, I forgot about that, yeah. I mean, it'd be nice if maybe they had gotten a Silver Age guy there, you know, but, you know.
They might at some time.
Yeah, that would be nice, yeah, because back in the day, you know, it was kind of like, not the Silver Age, but the Bronze Age, you'd see all sorts of people, that Roy Thomas be at shows, and they'd be dragging all sorts of people out, and you're like, oh, yeah, I remember him.
Well, my friend Britt in Dallas, I always learned a lot from him, because when I went to conventions, it was hitting the dealer's room, and the dealer's room only, and then I'd always go watch the movies or TV shows they had in another room. But mostly it was the dealer's room, just trying to find comics you couldn't find anywhere else. Well, Britt always did that, but he always talked to the creators, and if he didn't know who the creator was, he'd go and, you know, talk to them, find out what they're doing, usually buy their book, and he went to all the panels, which I never went to panel before. They're actually fantastic.
Sure.
But I remember one time he started reading a book. It was a Marvel book. But he met the two creators for it, talked to them for a long time. And I remember I was in the Navy at the time, and we talked about books he read. He says, I get whatever the book was, I guess. I think I'm probably the only person that gets it. But the reason he bought it is because he met the two creators. And I was thinking about at this convention, those two guys would have said hi. He would have stayed and talked to them for about an hour and got to know them, which I should have done. So, but I'm kind of a social misfit.
Well, I'm kind of like the same way, too. I went to a Heroes convention in 2006 in Charlotte, North Carolina. And, you know, Russ Heath was there. I was like, oh, I talked to him for a little bit. The Hernandez brothers were there. We watched we saw a panel that they were doing. But I'm kind of like George Tusker was there, Nick Carty. But I'm kind of like I just watch them because usually I'm not going to go there to buy a sketch. So I figure, you know, these guys want to sell sketches. It's nice to say hi and stuff like that. But, I mean, I'm not like, you know, I might not be like their primary customer. But I really should talk to these people a little more because, you know, who knows how much longer they have left. I mean, Jerry Robinson just passed away and people like that.
And even
Joe Simon.
And the new creators, they may be doing something you would like.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So I'm going to make a point. The next time I go, I'm going to try to talk to some of them if it's a show like this one.
Actually, at the Heroes Convention, I remember a really good artist, Mike Waringo, was there. He's just a young guy. He just passed away, too.
Yeah, he was really good.
He was very, very good. So,
and really nice. I've heard him on some podcasts. I wasn't familiar with him, but he would, I guess some of the shows had him on several times. Really nice guy, and the way he talked, he seemed like he didn't think he was very good. Well, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, and he was always like, I hope people like this. I don't know if they're... So I thought about it, so I saw the name, typed it into Google, and I don't know what artwork he was looking at, but yeah, it was something else.
Yeah, he was great. Yeah.
I started picking up, you know, trades when I see it. I liked his Fantastic Four work, and he had a blog, you know, friends would talk about. I guess he put a daily sketch up. He had a lot of Harry Potter stuff. He was really something else. You know, I'm sorry he's gone. He was pretty young to go.
Yeah, but I mean, like I said, I'm exactly like you. I'm like, I don't want to come off as Mr. Oh, really, I like your work, fanboy or whatever. But you know what? These guys may like it.
Well, I don't mind about being the fanboy. And if it is a creator I'm familiar with and like, I'm the top. In Tampa, they had a convention I went to, and they had Nicola Cootey and Joe Staton, who did E-Man. I enjoyed E-Man when I was a kid. I bought issues 6 through 10, and still have them, some of my favorite comics. I absolutely loved it. That was the first time, Plastic Man was always kind of wild and tongue-in-cheek, but this was the only other one I ever saw, and I remember when I first saw E-Man, this is stupid. Charlton's trying to do superheroes, and it looked dorky. And then for some odd reason, the sixth issue, it caught me. And I thought, why not? So I bought it. I absolutely loved it. At first, I kept thinking, what, is this supposed to be funny? It was kind of serious and kind of silly at the same time. And then Raj 2000, you know, by John Byrne, was in the back. And I loved it. And I was telling my friends, and they're like, is this supposed to be funny? And the next thing you know, they're collecting it too, you know. But I got the last, you know, five issues of the series, and they canceled it. But still, some of my favorites. Well, these two guys were going to be there, so I went and dug those issues out, walked over there. And Nicola Cootey was writing something or signing something. Joe Staton was right next to him, drawing a headshot for somebody. And I just asked if he'd sign some comics. Well, if I wrote them, sure. And so I pulled those out, and he just looked up at me, hey, Joe! And he showed those comics, and then, you know, Joe Staton was like, wow, those are old. And you know, they signed it, and they signed it to me, and they wrote a paragraph on each side of each issue.
That's cool.
But all five. I've never done that where I gave five, but, you know, why not? They were delighted. Now, I was wanting to talk to Nicola Cootie, but I guess they were showing his movie he made. So he signed them, finished it, passed them over to Joe Staten, and then he left. And then Joe Staten, he signed them all. Extremely, extremely nice. And he just made a comment about it. These books are in good shape. Well, the whole time in front of both of these men, I'm like, well, I've had these since I was a kid. They're some of my favorite ones. I could tell you each one where I got them at. You know, I mean, I was the starstruck kid, yeah, even though I'm 50.
Yeah.
But you know, Joe Staten had some guys around him. He was doing sketches, and I was trying to talk. But yeah, I turned into that guy. So I got to meet Nicola Cootie on Free Comic Book Day at Pat's store.
I did too. Yeah, he was real nice.
And yeah, he was really nice and extremely interesting. What I wanted to talk to him about was I always saw the stuff he wrote. He wrote those Raj 2000s for John Byrne. He wrote the E-Man. And I'd read stuff. I forgot that he was Wally Wood's assistant. And,
yeah.
You know, he wrote for him. But I didn't know he was an artist as well. And then when I was in the Navy, Heavy Metal would have these one-page stories he did. I remember one of them was about a crazy tattoo artist, and everybody was tattooed. And I was asking about that. I said, but you did the artwork for that too. And it was fantastic. And he said, well, he just realized at one point that he'd never really be able to make his living as an artist, and he concentrated on the writing. But, you know, we talked for quite a while. I bought his book, Mooney. I guess it's about that. I guess it's a soft porn book.
Oh, I never seen it.
He had 3 issues of a comic of it, and then he had a hardback. And I wanted to get the comics, but I guess that was the last issues, and it seemed like he was really trying to push the, you know, his trade. So I picked that up. And yeah, it was called Mooney. I guess it's kind of like Nudie Cuties or something. But
okay, he drew it or he just wrote it?
Well, it's got some spot illustrations, but it's, you know, it's a prose.
Prose. Okay.
It's prose. But right. Yeah, I've never read it. I should. I bought it. But he's a prolific writer, so I'm sure it's good.
He's a filmmaker now too. I think Pat at Comics World has one of his newer movies.
Yeah, they were showing one of his movies at the
horror movies, I think.
Well, this one, it looks like kind of like a Buck Rogers thing. He's in it. I think he plays a character in it.
You know what? Pat also has a comic book, and I can't remember the name of it now, but I'll find it and we'll put it on there, that he did maybe 6 or 7 years ago with Staten, and it was up on the wall, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but I will post it on there.
Yeah, but he has this one, it looked like a type of adventure Buck Rogers thing. I think he had a gun, like a ray gun or something.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm sure it was pretty neat. I should have went to see it when I was at a convention.
Yeah, the one Pat's got now is a horror movie. It's like some teenagers in the haunted house. Again, yeah, I mean, but he was really nice. And he started out, the little bit that I talked to him about, he started out working for Warren Publications. So.
Well, you've mentioned that before.
Yeah, and he was, he said, yeah, when I talked to him, he said, yeah, I was Wood's assistant, I was an editor for Creepy and Eerie, and yeah, he was nice as you can be. And Staten, I met him, I talked to him a little bit at a Heroes convention, but he was doing he was doing a sketch for my friend. I think he was doing a Green Lantern. He was real nice too. But the one, here's the kicker, the one that I could kill myself for not really talking to this guy, because I was just like, I was just plain stupid. We were at, this is years ago in the 80s, we were at a convention in Orlando. Me and a friend just like road tripped up there. Well, he was working for AmeriComics, Ralph Cabrera, who actually ended up working for inking for Marvel. And Ralph and I went up there, and he was doing a convention. I was just hanging out. And they had the artist table. And over on the corner was Wayne Boring. And I was like, oh, yeah, the Superman guy. He was nice and everything like that. But I was just like, I never thought to ask him for anything. And apparently he was doing, like, free sketches. So I was gosh.
The first convention I ever went to was in 1976 or 77 in Oklahoma. I never went to one before. I was just shocked. You know, there's a dealer's room. Me and my friend and my little brother were going through it. And what I was digging up was Dave Cockrum drawn issues of the Legion of Superheroes. To me, it was, you know, those were gone. They were old, well, not that old, but you couldn't find them at the 7-Elevens anymore. And to me, that was just a treasure chest. I found several. But I'm going through the convention, and then my brother keeps asking me about movies. He heard there was movies. One of the dealers I was buying books from said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "They're showing movies here on TV." "Really?" And he says, "Yeah." And I said, "Can we go see them?" "Oh, yeah, it's all part of your admission." You know, and he told me where it was. And he said, "You can see all the guests and everything." "What are the guests?" Well, on the flyer they had, it said, I guess they had some actor for something. I still don't know who it was, but it said EC artist George Evans. Well, wow. You got to remember, at that point in my life, I didn't know what EC was. I didn't know who George Evans was. And so, you know, I didn't go. Well, I would enjoy meeting him now.
Yeah, of course.
You know, if I could have gone back. But and then I never went to another convention until I was in college. They had one, again, Oklahoma City. And John Byrne was there. That was the big one. They brought Jordan Byrne. They brought a couple of guys from Chicago. They were, I guess they did their own fanzine, but they were actually really good cartoonists. And they also had Jack Cole.
Really? Jack Cole, Plastic Man?
Yeah, he was there. And I didn't realize who he was. I saw the name. I didn't know that. And then after the convention, that's when I found, because they had all the good girl art he was doing and the monster stuff.
The Playboy stuff.
They had that stuff, which I didn't think was, you know, I just saw it on the program in black and white. If I had known he was the guy done Plastic Man, I would have been first in line, you know. And I started realizing after the convention, "Well, is that the guy that did Plastic Man? Oh, my God." You know, I mean, but I didn't know at the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I did meet at a little show, Sheldon Moldoff, and I did get a Hawkman sketch from, like, you know, like in the 90s. And he was very nice, and I think he's still alive, actually. He might be one of the last living Golden Age artists.
Well, you know,
Nick Hardy, too.
I was reading about him, Sheldon Moldoff. He was, I guess he had a company, you know, doing artwork and stuff. And somebody said he did all the cartoons and stuff for Shoney's. You know, that chain of restaurants.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it was the little kids' booklets they give you to color and stuff. But they had a list of all these things he was doing. I thought, he's still, you know, this is, I guess, back in the 90s, you know.
Right.
But I thought, isn't that the guy that did Hogman?
Yeah, you know, the thing was,
Sugar
it was
and
like,
Spike.
Yeah, right. Sugar. Thing about it was, is when I was a kid, I used to buy the Batman books, 60s. And they all said Bob Kane. Years later, I found out it was actually Sheldon Moldoff who was drawing a lot of them under, you know, the name of Bob Kane. So I was like, oh, really? I mean, when I saw him at the convention, I was like, oh, these are nice Batman sketches. My friend goes, yeah, he was the guy who drew Batman. And said, oh, really? I didn't know that. I thought he was Hawkman guy. So I was like, okay.
Well, cool. He did a lot of stuff. And I think basically American Comics was him and Charlie Gaines.
It was?
I think so. It's in that DC Vault book you've got.
Okay.
But National Periodical, you know, it was all under that, I can't remember that man's name, Harry Donenfeld.
Yeah, Donenfeld, yeah.
But basically it was two separate companies. There was National and there was American. And National was, I can't think of the two men over there, but it was American was Charlie Gaines and Sheldon Moldoff, which is putting those books together.
Mm.
And that was the whole story. I saw William Gaines in Dallas in 1982.
You mean from EC?
Yeah, the Mad Magazine guy. It was really interesting. But he was talking about his dad, you know, and how his dad, you know, came up with this and that. And he said there's two young men that came into place with a new strip to put in, and it was Superman. And he looked at it and said, well, I'm pretty much filled up with what I got. He said, you might walk over to National. He says, they're trying to put together a new magazine. And I said, they might be interested in it. And then he said, after he finished saying that, I said, okay, now I told you about my dad's mistakes. Now let me tell you about all of mine. And, you know, he talked about all the things he did. But I didn't quite understand that there was two companies, you know. And, American had Wonder Woman, and they had Green Lantern. and National had on Superman, Batman, and the Flash. But from what I understood, even though they were separate companies, the characters crossed over in each other's books all the time. And I don't know, there was at one point where they just decided to put the two companies together. But yeah, Sheldon Moldoff was actually did quite a bit with American Comics. And I was always surprised that pretty diverse. I mean, you know, he did Hawkman. I guess he had more of a cartoony style, and he ended up doing the Sugar and Spike books. But he never seemed to stop.
No, it wasn't. I never realized that he was. I thought it was Sheldon Mayer who did the Sugar and Spike.
Oh, okay. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think it was Shelley Mayer who did the Sugar and Spike.
Okay, then maybe he was the one who was showing. Okay, everything I just said, just disregard. I've done it again.
I could have sworn, but anyway.
I think you're right, Sheldon Mayer.
Yeah, I'm pretty
because
I think Moldoff was basically like a more of a superhero guy.
He was. I never realized that. They were two separate people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, let's take a music break now, and we're gonna play this friend of mine, old friend of mine, Brian Yetter. He's a published author. He wrote a book, History of the Film in the Philippine Film Industry. He's doing a new book on Joe Namath, and he's also had a lot of articles written for Scream Magazine and a few other horror publications. And this is his. This is him as Blues Man, and this is his version of Little Red Rooster. So there you go.
Take it away.
I got the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for me. I got the little red rooster. Lazy to crow today. Keeps everything in the barnyard upset in every way. Dogs they begin to bark, and the hounds they all start to howl. And the hounds, they all start to howl. Well, that's just a warning. My little red rooster's on the prowl. We'll be right back.
Okay, we're back.
All right, I think there was a correction you want to make.
Yes, that song was by my friend Brian Yetter, and I wanted to make sure I got his book title right, so it's called Cinema of the Philippines, A History and Filmography by McFarlane Books. And it's a great book. I've read it. I've enjoyed it, and it's very interesting reading.
Well, then you've talked about it before, too.
I have talked about it, yeah.
Actually, it's funny. I didn't know that, you know, this musician was the same guy, because you've talked about that. We talk about Filipino movies quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. He knows them right and left. So. I remember for a while there, for like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, he would go to the Philippine market and just rent whatever they had. And I remember seeing some of the notes. He just watched movies constantly and had like an incredible index of films. And apparently when the book got published, McFarlane didn't publish the complete index. I think he had like hundreds more movies that like he didn't even get in there. So hopefully they'll redo it again with the complete book. But it is a very excellent book, definitely. And he's a great musician, as you can tell from Little Red Rooster. Maybe we'll play some more and on some other episodes.
That's very nice. Yeah, you know, when I went to the Philippines, I had never seen anything in other than English. And I was kind of interested, so I saw they had a movie theater, so I went to the movies. And I was the only American in the theater, you know. It was a Tagalog movie. But the guy sitting next to me said, "Do you speak Tagalog?" "No." "Why are you here?" "Oh, I wanted to see a Philippine movie." You know, okay. So when the movie starts, he starts explaining to me, you know, what's going on. Okay. And the movie's going on. Yeah, I don't know what's happening, but these guys are arguing. A guy pulls out a gun and shoots this man in the chest. And the bullets just bounce off his chest, like the old George Reeves Superman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then he'd reach over and pick up one of the bullets. These guys are all panicking, and he put it in his mouth and crunch it. And they'd all run away. And I'm sitting there like, okay. Well, the guy next to me, you know, the one that's telling me this thing, he goes, "Okay, this man has an unting-unting."
What?
And then the person next to me goes, on the other side, goes, "Oh, yeah, it gives you supernatural powers." "Really?" And then the woman sitting in front of me turns around and says, "Yes, yes, some people can get it. It's very special." "It's real?" And then the person behind me is like, "Oh, yeah, it's real, but it doesn't work on Friday." And, I mean, like I said, everybody around me became, you know, to me, I appreciated it. I thought that was very nice, you know. But basically, everybody in the theater thought they'd help me out. And it was pretty wild. One thing I was surprised, a lot of things were happening. He had a sidekick around him all the time. And I guess the sidekick had a sister, a beautiful sister. Again, even though they were telling me stuff, a lot of it I was just missing. I didn't understand the language. I didn't understand any of this. And, you know, it was all different. But come to find out, everybody kept talking about the main actor who was playing. The movie was called Capitan Ingo. And the actor was a mayor of a town. And they kept telling me this. Well, I realized that mayor of the town was Estrada. He became the president of the Philippines in the late 90s. And I guess a lot of people were upset about that. You know, he was an actor. Well, we had an actor as president, too. But Estrada's record was actually really good. Everybody talked about it. But somebody said what he'd do was hire a bunch of thugs to go into towns and work people over if they were causing trouble. I don't know. But the sidekick was Dolphy, which was one of my wife's favorite. He's a comedian.
Yeah, sounds
and
familiar.
Even if you don't understand the language, Dolphy can really crack you up. My mother-in-law absolutely loved him. To me, he was the king of Philippine movies. We have a movie at the house on old tape, but it was about World War II, and he played a bakla, a gay. And basically, I don't know the whole story to it, but they were living in a cave during World War II when the Japanese were there. And every time when my parents-in-law lived with us, every time I walk in the house, I'd hear you know, the music from that movie. My mother-in-law watched that thing constantly. And Dolphy would sing songs and be silly. when I was in the Navy, I've seen so many of his movies on the ship, you know, Filipinos that get tapes and play them. But there's one scene at Capitan Ingo where Capitan Ingo was in the bedroom with that guy's sister upstairs. And it was a sex scene. But it shows these two, you know, getting hot and, you know, kissing and stuff. And then it shows Dolphy downstairs walking to the bathroom. And he gets a toothbrush. And while, you know, Captain Ingo is kissing and, you know, doing this with his lady, Dolphy pulls out the toothbrush. And then later she starts, and all of a sudden he puts the toothpaste on it. And it finally, at one point, it shows the Capitan, you know, you could tell it was what was happening. And then it showed Dolphy put the toothbrush in his mouth and starts brushing his teeth. And it switches back and forth. And I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting there with my mouth open like, you know, I can't hardly breathe. Like, I can't believe this happened. Everybody in the theater is just busting up. Women are laughing and screaming. Guys, you couldn't help but laugh, you know. And then, is you know, they're getting more hot and heavy upstairs. And you start hearing the one, All of a sudden, Dolphy starts brushing his teeth. But, I mean, pretty vigorous.
Yeah, gotcha.
And then it switches back upstairs, and they're getting faster and yelling louder, and it switches back to Dolphy, and, you know, he's got this dazed look on his face like he's oblivious. And he's brushing his teeth as fast as he can, and then it goes back up, and all of a sudden the woman really starts to pant and scream, and then it shows Dolphy.
Oh, no, I get
and
it.
Toothpaste
I gotcha.
Is coming out of the mouth. And by that time, the screams and the howls were going, I couldn't believe it. And then it, you know, it switches back up to him again. And then it comes back down. All of a sudden, his gums start bleeding with all the toothpaste. I never forgot that. That was amazing. And but the unting, the guy on my ship, I was telling him about it. And he said, you went to see Capitan Ingo. I said, you know, that's a true story. That's what the people in the theater kept telling me. It's a true story. So the guy was getting bullets bounced off him. Oh, he had an unting-unting. Well, what was his unting-unting? And I never really got quite the straight story. They tell me it gives you supernatural powers. But, you know, which interested me. But they said, do you have one? Oh, no. Does anybody you know have one? Well, a friend of mine in another town, he knew somebody that had one. No, I never knew one. And but, you know, the guy was really nice. He says, but a lot of people believe it, so it must be true. Well, it was in the 90s. I started reading. It was a martial arts magazine. It was talking about, maybe I'm wrong. I think the guy's name's Floro Villabre. He's in Hawaii, Filipino in Hawaii. But he was a Eskrima master. And he fought death matches, you know, where basically one person ended up leaving. And my instructor knew who he was. But he had an unting-unting, and he said he couldn't be harmed. And they said at one point he was in a, you know, the Filipinos at the time worked in a Filipino pineapple plantations. And they said he took a hot machete, which they used to, you know, cut down a sugar cane, and somebody sliced his leg, and all of a sudden blood started coming out, and everybody's flabbergasted. And his wife got on to him and said, don't you know it's Friday? It's Good Friday. Well, the unting-unting is a gift from God, but it won't, they say, but it doesn't work on Good Friday, you know. So,
okay, that's bad luck, I guess.
But I love those stories. My father-in-law started telling me all these stories. You get them through trials. You basically live in the jungle, you know, and my wife said if you really want one, the stories were that, you know, you basically just live off the land, you eat worms, whatever you have to do to survive, you know, like what the Green Berets or Special Forces would do. And then at one point, you may be lucky in the jungle and find one. I've heard stories about certain anthills are bigger than others, and if you jam your fist down in the anthill, you'll pull a little person out. And the little person would have one. You can make them give it to you. My father-in-law told me sometimes you can find them in a tree, in the jungle, like a little knot in a tree. You see one, and you can pull out a scroll. And he said if you take the scroll, it'll tell you whatever you need to know. And he said you can read it, and all of a sudden you know how to do it, and you put it back in. Really? I also heard if somebody has an unting-unting, they can give it to you. and it won't work for them anymore. It'll work for you, but you have to have the object with you. It could be a machete, you know, a necklace, a ring, whatever. They basically pass the power. And you can't get money. You can't use money for it. My instructor told me about a man in his... There was two men in his town. One man could just take his hand right in front of your mouth, not touch your mouth, and yank, and your bad teeth will come out. He can remove your bad teeth just in one pull. And he said, really? Oh, yeah, done. He says, this man had so many... He always had people circling his house, because I guess, you know, way back then, people would have, you know, bad teeth, abscessed teeth and stuff. So they go to him. But he said he lost the unti-unti. Why? Well, he started taking money. You know, he started requesting money when people came in. So it lost. Well, what happened? Oh, he still continued to remove teeth. He got a big pair of pliers. I said, why? He goes, well, he had such a reputation, people still came to him. But he told me another story that had always stayed with me. It was, he said, you see this man, you never saw him eat. You never ever saw him eat, but he always had a raw rice, you know, with the shells in his teeth. He was always sucking on them, just, you know, like between his teeth and gums, and I guess kind of like snuff, but it was always the raw rice with the husk on it. And he said, you couldn't touch him. And you see him sometimes, you know, laying outside, you know, on a chair or something, just sleeping. And the kids would come over and try to touch, and he'd just barely move out of the way, even when he'd sleep. He said, you couldn't touch him. Really? He says, no, that was a thing. Nobody could touch him. They tried to touch him, he'd just, you know, move. And he says, sometimes, you know, the kids were always trying to do it. He says, but he just, it was always amazing how he got out of the way. I said, that's not a good thing to have. He says, what if you want to get married? The woman, oh, no, done. If he wants you to touch him, it's okay. If you don't want to touch, you can't. Really? But I don't know, those stories always fascinated me. The one, I'll stop talking about this in just 1 second, but my father told me one story that I just can't get past. He said these men were building a church, and not, you know, in their town. This is a long time ago. But he said they'd been working all day long out in the middle of nowhere, and then when the day was finished, these men were, you know, had a fire and they were cooking. And this one man walked over and says, I'm really hungry, what do we got? Rice. That's all we have is rice? We worked here all day, just, well, that's all we have. Oh, that's no good. He says, I'm going to go to Subic and get some, you know, vegetables. Subic? Subic, I guess, is 40 miles away. You know, this is a long time ago. I'll be back. So he walked away. Well, one of the guys in this group followed him, secretly. And the guy got to another section where nobody was at. He pulls out a bandana. He folded it in half like a triangle, and then he just stepped over it, and he disappeared.
Wow.
The guy ran back to the people freaking out. What's your problem? He just stepped over his bandana and disappeared. And they're all laughing at him. And then the guy came over later, you know, not maybe 10, 15 minutes later, and he had this basket of fresh-cut vegetables. And there was one vegetable they say only grows in Subic. You know, it doesn't grow in the other areas, in Zambales, where my wife lived. But he said, they looked at it, and it was freshly cut. I mean, somebody just got the, you know, machete and just cut it right there. And I remember he told me that I was supposed to be fixing the grill. You know, my parents-in-law and my sister-in-law came down for vacation. And I was outside fixing it. My father-in-law never talks. He rarely, you know, he's... If you get 3 to 5 words out of him, it's something. For some odd reason, he and I are talking about Arnis, you know, the martial arts, and we got to talk about Unti-Untings. He was telling me one story after another, and he told me that, and I sat there and listened for 2 hours. My wife came out, got so upset at me she could only talk that I never fixed the grill. You know, the sun went down, I couldn't fix it. I don't care. That was gold to me. And, you know, I fixed it the next day, everything was all right. But when I was telling my wife and sister-in-law that story the next day, they were getting goosebumps. They didn't want to hear it anymore. And when I mentioned that vegetable in Subic, oh, yeah, that's, you know, they said some name I didn't know. But I want that power.
It's like a superhero.
Well, I kept thinking of Superman. But my father-in-law told me the way it worked was you learn how to do something well. He said it could be speed, or you could transport like that, or you could be not harmed, like Capitan Ingo or that Arnis master. There was other things too. You always hear these stories. I wish I could find, every time people go to the Philippines, they always ask me, what are you wanting to bring back? And I said, I want, any kind of book about Unting Untings. Now, it's always stories other people tell you, like my instructor. One of the dads at the karate school, they heard my instructor tell stories, and he was laughing about, there's some type of a citrus fruit in the Philippines, some type of orange. And he says, every time you see young men eat them, they spit the seeds out in their hand, in their palm of their hand, they're looking at them. And he said, if the seeds move, that's very precious, save them. He said, as soon as they see that, they'd wrap in cellophane, they always kept it moist, always kept water on it. And he said, the reason why, if the seed moves, if you have it in your mouth, you're irresistible to women. So that's why young men are always getting it. And I thought, really? And I says, if you're lucky enough to have the seed that moves, you keep it moist. If there's a woman you like, you put it in your mouth, and then, the woman comes, she's yours.
Wow, now that sounds like a movie.
Yeah, I know. I just think that's why, I don't know, there's a treasure trove of Philippine movies. Unfortunately, I don't speak the language, and you don't really see them. I've seen some of them. We had some tapes, but since they went to DVD, I don't see them anymore.
I think you got to find a Filipino supermarket, and I think they have some.
Well, they used to rent them when they were tapes, but I don't see the DVDs.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
Well,
I don't know.
Philippines, the DVD region is Region 3, which doesn't
play
in.
Yeah, you're right.
Which is sad, because a lot of Filipinos in the United States. There's got to be a way around it, but.
Yeah, you're right, because all the stuff that he reviewed was from videotapes.
Oh, yeah. Well,
hundreds of videotapes.
My wife used to rent movies all the time. Our friend Martin on BOD, he's always talking about the Filipino Batman.
I have that movie, yeah.
Well, we rented it.
Elias, Batman, and Robin, I think it was called.
Well, the guy in the movie.
Oh, and there was one called James Batman, too, that I have somewhere.
Oh, I never saw.
Oh, James Batman's a musical, too.
Well, the Batman movie I saw at the end, it's all it's a girl dressed as Wonder Woman, and Batman and Robin, they're all dead.
I have that movie. Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, that guy that played Batman in the movie, there was a trio in the Philippines when I was there that were huge called Tito, Vic, and Joey. And they were the kings of the one-liners. And even if you don't understand Tagalog, they're just absolutely hilarious. They had movies. I remember seeing a movie called Doctor, Doctor, We Are Sick. But they had a variety show. I used to see in the Philippines, and people would illegally pirate them and rent the tapes at Philippine supermarkets here, in San Francisco and stuff. But their show was fantastic. They used to take pop songs like Weird Al, put them in Tagalog, but they're always funny. They had this old man that I guess had no teeth. He kind of looked like Popeye. He could make all these funny faces, and I think he sold a vinegar or something, like the spokesman or. But guys on my ship had cassette tapes of Tito, Vic, and Joey. And they were just absolutely hilarious, even if you don't speak the language. But when the Batman came out, I think that was Joey, alone. And my wife thinks one of those guys passed away. They broke up, I guess. But I guess in the late 80s, early 90s, one of them died.
Hmm.
But the Filipino Batman, my wife rented it and told me about it, so I watched it later. It was okay, kind of.
It's a hoot.
Yeah, well, Martin, he's just fascinated by it. And then the other two guys in the BOD, we were eating lunch one day, and they said, can you tell me about the Filipino Batman? So I told them, but I guess they were always bewildered. The BOD is the Bunch of Dorks, which is linked to our site. It's another podcast that basically Dallas got interested in doing this one because of those guys, so he might give them a listen.
And Martin also does Slow Robot A Go Go, where he does his funny movie reviews of sci-fi and.
Yeah, 50s sci-fi.
50s sci-fi. He's going into the 80s now. He's getting more modern, I think.
That's a really good show. I do enjoy it. And I don't know the titles when he describes the movie. I remember every one of those at the drive-in when my aunt used to.
Oh, God, yeah.
I used to go. my aunt would go on dates, and I'd always go to these drive-ins that showed those B sci-fi movies from the 50s, and I used to see them on TV. But every one he's described, I remember.
Yeah, they're all the creature features.
Yeah, he does them out of South Korea.
Oh, yeah. Well, soon to be back in the good old U.S. of A., but right now still in Korea. But, yeah, definitely Slow Robot, A Go-Go, and a bunch of dorks. But, yeah, the Philippines, you know, we've talked about their comics before, but, the Batman movies. And, well, the ones that Brian and I first saw, I mean, he was in Pennsylvania. I was down here with the Mad Doctor of Blood Island trilogy. The Blood Island trilogy was Mad Doctor of Blood Island, Brides of Blood, and Beast of Blood. And they had Eddie Garcia, who's like the big star over there. It's been a big he's like in his 80s now, and he's still, I think he's still doing movies. I'm not sure, but he was the star. He was in all three of them, and he's a great actor. They're a lot of fun. But that's how we got into him, and then Brian, took it to a whole different level.
Oh, yeah, it sounded like you wrote the book. I'd like to see that.
Oh, yeah, I'll show it to you. I got it right here.
Oh, excellent.
It's a real nice book. I mean, he's really... It was kind of like such a, like I said, I would talk to him as he was writing, and it was really a lot of work. Well, like I said, he's got the Joe Namath book coming out now, and that was years in the making, like reading up all these, all the transcripts of the games, and he actually got videos of some of the games. So I think that's coming out for McFarlane 2 this year, and that should be another excellent book.
Wow.
Yeah, his Scream magazine article that he just did, I think it's Scream 23, was about the Mexican Boris Karloff movies. And that's really interesting because those are the last movies Karloff ever did, and they're not his best, but Brian really does a good job of... I'll lend those to you. He does a really good job of watching those movies and giving you a lot of information. And actually, I read stuff that I didn't know about him. So
I didn't know Boris Karloff did Mexican movies.
Like in the late 60s, he did four movies in Mexico. Half in Mexico, half in the United States, and they were done for, I think they were done basically for television, but he wanted I think $100,000, and that was a big, maybe even more than that. That was pretty big, but they offered to do it. But from what I read in the article that Brian wrote, basically Karloff said, look, just like in a few years I want a vacation in Mexico, so instead of giving me the money, just like hold it for me there, and when I come down there, that'll pay for my vacation. Of course, he passed away in 69, so he never did get that.
That was still cool.
But still, I mean, they're not the best movies that he ever did, but they have a lot of atmosphere. And one of them in particular, The Snake People, is pretty good, actually, for what it is. You got to take it for what it is.
Right.
It's B-movie, dub, the whole nine yards. But yeah. So yeah, and Brian always does a great job on those. He also did an article on the... masked wrestler Mil Máscaras, I got the little masked wrestler guy over there, and those are great movies too. When they're actually superheroes and they fight monsters and everything, but they brought Mil Máscaras was from that era, still alive, and he did a new movie a couple of years ago. So yeah, it's all great stuff.
Yeah, we were talking about the masked wrestlers movies.
Those are a hoot.
I couldn't believe it. I saw on the ship. We were close to Tijuana. And there was a lot of guys on my ship that were, either from Mexico or Mexican descent. And they were watching one of the Spanish channels on the ship. And it was a black and white movie. I just came in from town, was going to my locker, and I was getting ready to leave. And all these guys are sitting there watching this movie. And I turn and I look, and it's this woman and this man in a suit with a luchador mask. And I stopped and looked at it, And it was serious. It was a drama, and the woman was getting upset, and he was telling her something, and she was getting upset. And I didn't bother those guys. I'm just kind of looking. And, I closed my locker, and I'm getting ready to leave, and I couldn't stop watching it. And then one of the guys, I guess, realizing I was perplexed, he goes, well, Don, that's, what did you say? It was El Santo?
Santo, yeah, Santo.
He told me his name. He said, why is he wearing a mask? Well, he was a wrestler. Why is he wearing a suit? Well, he's the movie. He's playing this man. They start explaining the story and why the woman was upset and what he's doing. But why is he wearing a mask now? Well, because, he was a wrestler. He was famous for that. well, why is he wearing a suit with a mask? You know, I just couldn't get
he's
past
kept going
it.
Going on and on, yeah.
You know, and these guys are like, you know, oh, no, because he was really famous. He did a lot of movies, but he was a really popular wrestler since people loved him so much. Well, again, it was a cultural thing. I just couldn't grasp the concept.
Well, it was a secret identity. He didn't want to give away exactly who he was.
It was Gilbert Hernandez, I think, in Love and Rockets, wrote about him. And he told the whole story how he was a wrestler and, you know, how the people just loved him. And he was so popular that he did movies. But he did them with the mask.
And he never took the mask off.
Because, like you said, that was who he was famous for, so he played it. But he didn't play a wrestler in the movies. He was an actor with... But like I said, all I could see was a luchador mask. And
well, he was a real wrestler. I mean, he did wrestle for
He was a, what I understand, he was a fantastic wrestler.
He was a fantastic wrestler, and then he became a movie star. He was like the Superman of Mexico.
But I think that's the, that's absolutely, I think that's a unique thing to Mexico.
Definitely, yeah.
So, but you know, when the first time you see it, it's just like.
It's surreal. You know,
but I stayed and watched the whole movie, even if I didn't understand it.
Well, you know, for me, it was, I remember seeing him as a kid in Miami, and it was, oh, well, who's this guy? And all of a sudden, it's like a monster comes out, and I'm like, yeah, monsters, all right, this is cool. Yeah, it's like, he's got a cape, he's a superhero, and he's fighting monsters, all right, I like that. And then from then on, it became kind of like, you know, oh, yeah, Santo and Blue Demon and, you know, all the other guys that you know, showed up, Mel Mascaris, there was tons of them. Well, and Santo actually had comic books. He did have comic books in the 70s, and they were the photograph, the Fumetti type of comic books.
Oh, okay.
They actually, every panel was a story. You know, it was, I think they were shot especially for the comic book, too, even though I may have seen some that had maybe a scene or two from the movie, but I remember seeing them when I used to live in Miami, at a 7-Eleven, but I never bought one. A friend of mine did, but I never bought one. I wish I would have now. But, yeah, they are out there, and I'll post a picture of them. But what was really interesting is the original ones had Santo, the real Santo. Either after he passed away or whatever, there are some, which are Santo comics, but it's a different guy playing Santo, and he looks younger, and he's bigger, and he's like... But it's like, wait a minute, that's not Santo. This is Santo over here, you know. So, but, yeah. It's definitely like a cultural Mexican thing, or even Southern California, but it's very popular.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it's actually neat. You know, like I said, Gilbert Hernandez did a whole section of him, which I really enjoyed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think Gilbert puts him in his stories, too. I'm not sure, though, but I think he does, too.
It's so awesome, no. I mean, I thought it was kind of cool then, but I couldn't get past, why is this guy wearing a mask?
I think I have a couple of subtitle ones. I'll have to make you a copy of
them. Well, you know, fighting dinosaurs and stuff, or monsters, that would make sense, you know. But, I mean, as a regular drama, which this movie was, it was a really good movie, even though I
But was it was it a straight drama, or was he playing like a spy or something? Whatever you watched was dramatic.
It could have been, you know.
Because I just remember seeing one where he was like trying to be a suave spy. He's got like a turtleneck sweater on, and he's walking around. And it's just like, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's really cool.
That's very interesting. Okay, yeah, you know, he's like a superhero. He's got his car, the Santo Mobile. I think it's like a Jag. It's a really nice Jag. He's got a like Batman. He's got like an underground laboratory where he does the. It's totally awesome, dude. Totally awesome. Santo rules. So, yeah, man. So anyway, let's do the reading portion of the. Of the proceedings. What are you reading, Don?
Well, I guess since it's the comic book podcast, we should talk about some comic books. So, one thing I just brought up, one of my favorite artists was J.C. Mezières. He did a French comic called Valerian. In the United States in the 80s, a company called Dargold put out four of their volumes in English, which to this day remains some of my favorite work. They've got, I'm going to say, maybe 25 Valerian volumes in France. What always upset me was the other ones I'd read about. I've got a couple in French, but I've never seen them in English. I think NBM at one point in the late 80s or early 90s got the license to it, and they put out those same four volumes, and they had plans to do others, and then I guess the company went away. Well, I whined and moaned and whined and moaned all this time, and then I found out that a company called Sinbook is putting them out. The first two volumes of Valerian and Loreline are out. The one I'm talking about now is The City of Shifting Waters. I guess what they're going to do is do each book in sequence all the way up to the end. And this first book, The City of Shifting Waters, they're basically on the cover, they're in Manhattan Island. And it looks like something from Blade Runner. It's all overgrown. It's flooded. They're in a little boat going through it. The story is they go back in time to 1986. Of course, this book came out in like 1964 or so.
But from 64, really?
Yeah, I think the original date is it's in the early 60s. Well, that's what amazes me. Now, this book, compared to the later work, it's a little more, the character is a little more cartoony.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And more cartoony.
But the architecture and his style is still where it was later on. His compositions are just, I don't know if this has been recolored. The colors to these books is just, to me, equally right up there with J.C. Mazieres. He uses that fantastic blue light. But in the story, Pierre Christensen, he over-explains some things a lot. It kind of messes up the narrative a bit, which went away in the later volumes. I guess, you know, if this is some of your first work, it's that way. But what amazes me is how forward-thinking it was. Basically, the ice caps melted. There was an atomic explosion. I guess everybody kept all their atomic weapons in the South Pole. But after that, it caused all the polar ice caps to melt, flooded the place. The whole world was hit by tsunamis, which I have never heard of until a couple of years ago.
Yeah, right. So yeah.
You know, now it's something everybody talks about. There's a restaurant here in town called Tsunami.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But back in the 60s when this was done, I never heard of that. And at one point, Valerian and Loreline end up meeting this. There's people in boats going around basically ransacking Manhattan Island. They're taking all the gold, cash, any kind of anything that, you know, is worth money. Well, the captain of the ship is a black man. And he starts working with Valerian. Come to find out, he's just keeping these. He knows none of the stuff is going to be worth anything. The world's not going to come back the way it was. And he's just keeping these guys occupied, kind of using them as a workforce. And they talk about after this, that's when the whole world kind of came back together and created the utopian future that they're living in now. Well, it's all because of this one man. Well, at the time, I keep thinking of the time frame. Can you imagine a black man in that position in American comics?
Really, not for 64?
Even in the 80s. You know, now you see these things all the time, but I think in 64, that was, he's a really strong character, but I like how he thinks. He seems really tough and rough, but he's also extremely intelligent, and he's forward-thinking. And since the world lost the entire infrastructure, they could rebuild it. And I'm so happy. I'm praying to God that Cinebuck doesn't go bankrupt like everybody else printing these, but I got two volumes in English, and hopefully there's going to be quite a few more.
Cool. Yeah, they are nice. I mean, I can see how the art evolves from the very cartoony to the more, to the still cartoony, but more sophisticated,
right,
you know, as it goes on. And the settings in the backgrounds are kind of like we were talking about one time, you could see where like certain movies got certain ideas from some of these spaceships and some movies George Lucas did, I think.
Well, the second volume, The Empire of a Thousand Planets, it's a big leap forward because it looks more like, you know, the stuff that they were printing later. I haven't read that one yet. I've just looked at the pictures, which
which is fantastic.
I'm happy these are coming up. Anyway, what do you got?
Okay, well, I got a book here by one of my favorite Golden Age artists, Bob Powell. It's called Bob Powell's Terror. Powell started out with Eisner and Iger Studio doing Lady Luck, I think he was working on, and he did a lot of stuff. He did Jet Powers, I think, in the 50s, but he ended up doing, just like everybody else did in the 50s, EC-style horror stories. And this is a collection of them from IDW. It came out. It's pretty new. Powell's great. He's got like this great style, which is kind of like semi-cartoony but semi-realistic. And he just draws the craziest looking monsters in this. I was talking to Don. My favorite one is the first one. I think it's called the Wall of Flesh, where it's like a mad scientist who's creating a artificial flesh for a transplant victims gets spurned by his young nurse love interest. So to get revenge, he throws her into the wall of flesh and it starts eating her. It's so disgusting. But it's like, these stories are like, you know, awesome. I mean, these are from the 50s and they had to compete with EC. So it was like, okay, well, you know, this whole thing is full of like, they're all like 5-page stories. I think a lot of these are from Archie, Harvey. Powell did Sheena. He did The Man in Black, Mr. Mystic. Looks like he did some Shadows. He was the penciler in the old Batman cards from the 60s too, which were painted.
Oh, I remember those.
Yeah, which were painted by Norman Saunders afterwards, but he was the basic penciler.
Yeah,
so
I had some of those Batman in the Whirlpool. Yeah,
he did. He did work for Atlas afterwards, and he did mostly Harvey, I think. But he did work for Marvel in the 60s. I think he did some Daredevils, and I'm not sure what else he did. I think he did some either Human Torch or Thing stories, but he wasn't inked properly, so you couldn't. It wasn't as good as some of the stuff. This guy, he was better when he was left alone to do the full work, or when he was inked by Howard Nostrand, another artist from
era. He worked in Crack Magazine.
Powell worked for Sick Magazine, actually. They both did work for the Mad Imitators, and he also did a few things for Eerie Publications, including a really nice cover. Unfortunately, Bob Powell died in 67, so, I mean, he really didn't do much work in the Silver Age, but most of this stuff from the 50s and 60s is really beautiful. I mean, the layouts are like wild. He's always got some interesting storytelling things. This one here, the Rat Man, is like, it's really nice because it's shot, it looks like a shot from the originals in black and white with some blue tones, and it's definitely like it's definitely worth.
Yeah, that one you just mentioned is my favorite story in there. I like how it looks. He's got a clean look, but his stuff's got a lot of rendering in it.
It's got a lot of rendering. It's a clean look, and it's always like, I mean, it's good because it fits the tone of the story. And this guy could do everything. He's doing these horror stories. He was doing the Sheena Jungle stuff. I think he did Thunder also, the jungle guy. He would be doing like humor strips. These are reprinted from the original comic books, and it's in. IDW actually did a good job because the paper's kind of like tan too, so you get a feeling like you're reading the old comic book. And it's all, like I said, it's all from the strips, but definitely, Bob Powell is a great artist, and this is definitely worth buying.
We were talking about the cover. The cover, basically, it's like a mask.
Some monster.
Yeah, it's like
a guy.
His face is kind of decaying. And when you open it up on the end papers, it's two more masks.
Yeah, right.
And then
you go to the back.
Yeah, you flip it over the back cover, and it's a half-tone photo of his headshot. And they cut that out as a mask. It's a guy with glasses, a kind of happy look. You know, and when you open that up, the back end papers is two more horrifying creatures.
Horrifying creatures, yeah.
And I don't know, I just think that's great fun. You know, he's just another mask in these things, but he just looks like a really nice guy.
And even though they're grim, they are fun. Yeah. I think IDW is doing out a series. I think the first one was Dick Briefer's Frankenstein from the 50s, and I don't know what the next one is, but yeah, definitely. I you know, obviously I love Pals, so the art gets a 10. The story's, you know, 6, 7, depending on what story it is. And of course, you can tell by now that I'm really a fan of the short story, so this is right up my alley.
Well, I'll tell you, it's really nice looking, but that work is certainly 50s. I mean, you can see it's from the 50s. I've seen people try to draw like that since, and it just never has that look anymore.
No, I've seen some people do it. They come close, but it's not the same.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Even at Erie Publications, we talked about a few episodes ago, I was looking through those, and they still have that 50s look. And you said, yeah, they were basically just reprints from old books in the 50s. But
yeah, look at that one.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
But it's just, I don't know why. There's something about the comics work in the 50s that they've never replicated. It has any generation has its own style and look. But
yeah, that's something that I'd like to talk about. It's something I was thinking about, and I can't place my finger on it right now, but it's just, and it happened by looking at some old Charlton comics. I got a few old ones, and I was looking at ones from the early 50s, and they kind of look like Golden Age.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, around 57 or 58, something changed. It was either the inking style got cleaner, or the renderings of the people became maybe more modernized. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it. I have to really think about it more. But yeah, this is kind of like, this does look a little bit like Golden Age, but it does. But the people are kind of 50-ish looking, so it kind of like, it's hard to figure out where to place it. It definitely looks Golden Age, but it's a little more sophisticated. I mean, the renderings are a little cleaner and tighter than it would be.
Well, and they, you know, that's another thing. They have good compositions in it. I mean, everything's well done, but it just seems like it's not as sophisticated as what came out later in some ways.
And no.
More sophisticated than stuff that came out later in other ways. Sometimes I see the layouts and even the way they laid the panel, you know, the drawing of the panel, it's a little awkward. But there's a lot of effort put in everything.
Yeah, all the backgrounds are very detailed, and everybody obviously looks like they're in their 50s, the hairstyles and the clothing and stuff like that. Yeah, he's definitely a guy that, I mean, by the time he started doing work in the 60s, it still looked a little old-fashioned.
Yeah.
But it was cool, though, because, you know, I mean, it was just, it had this... His style is really nice. I mean, he really has a nice style, and that's very important. I mean, a lot of these guys can draw really well, but a lot of times what differentiates a great one from a good one is a nice style, and Bob Powell is definitely a stylish.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Stylish artist.
Well, you know, Jack Kirby was talking about when he first started out, the interviewer was talking about how many pages he had done, you know, when he was quite young in the 40s and the 50s. And at one point in the interview, he started explaining that, well, we did a lot of pages. You got to remember, sometimes a panel could just be a little tiny airplane flying and, you know, a little caption, and that was it. And he says it wasn't like now where, you know, every panel's, you know, heavily drawn and everything. But he says at the same time, even though it was just a plane and a panel with like a meanwhile or something, he said we still put all of our best effort even on that little bit. But I remember some of the old work Gil Kane did was the same way. It wasn't much compared to what he started doing much later.
And these guys drew everything, unlike a lot of people now. They did horror, they do romance, they do westerns, they do the war books, you name it. They did every genre, and they did it well, I think.
Well, he did, and that's one thing I like in this, is he does all kinds of stories. I see masked crime fighters, I see adventurers, yep. I see, you know, again, the horror stuff. I noticed that in that book, when they did the horror, the rendering is really heavy and dark. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the jungle stuff, it's the cleaner, even if you've got some of the fine lines for the detail and the rendering.
Yeah, like, you know, the superhero stuff is very, like, you know, clean and styled. But then you get the horror stuff, and he definitely goes, like, really into the ugly faces and the the creatures. But, yeah, I mean, definitely Bob Powell, honestly. He's like one of these guys. When I was a kid, I didn't like the Golden Age guys that much because I was already, you know, I was a Silver Age guy.
Oh, yeah.
But he was one of the ones that I liked for some reason. I don't know what it is about his work, but I've always loved it. So, anyway, I guess that wraps up the show, right?
Yeah, well, we talked about comic books for about 5 minutes.
you think maybe Dallas might have something to say? I don't know.
Yeah, he said he would. So,
so Dallas, come on, help us out. All right, well, that's it for another episode.
Yeah, thanks for listening. We'll see you later.
All right, bye.
And that's going to wrap it up for this one, folks. Thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find our other episodes on our blog page. It's twodimensionpodcast.blogspot.com. And underneath the links to each episode, there's pictures and more links so you can read further about whatever we talked about on that particular show. And if you think of it, leave a comment below the show also, and we'll get back to you. You can also find us and friend us on Facebook. Just look up Two Dimension Podcast. And check out my webcomic if you get a chance. It's called The Mighty Blue, and it's at mightybluecomic.blogspot.com. All right, that's going to wrap it up, and I guess we'll see you guys next episode. So thank you all for listening, and take care of yourselves and read more comics.